Okay, thank you, Doreen. Thanks a lot for having me here at the program and allowing me to give a talk. It's a pleasure to be back. Actually, I was here at the KRTP about 5 years ago, and when preparing this talk with this cryptic title, Pentagon Functions, I realized that so 5 years ago I was working on hexagon functions. So it seems like we made negative progress. So one of the things I'm going to have to explain is why is it now pentagon functions and used to be hexagon functions. But more seriously, what I'm interested in are methods for computing scattering amplitudes relevant, for instance, to the LHC. And a bottleneck in such calculations, especially for virtual amplitudes, are the loop integrals. So I'm going to talk about some developments in our understanding of loop integrals and our understanding of methods for computing those. And there are two recent applications of this, one for pentagons, so 2 to 3 processes, at the two-loop level, and if I have time, I might also, as an example of the general methods, tell you something about a recent calculation for four-loop form factors. So these are objects with fewer external legs, but higher loops. I should also apologize that I guess this is at one end of the spectrum of this workshop, so I'm a theorist, as you can tell. So I do hope that I can say also things that are understandable to some extent to experimenters. In any case, feel free to interrupt me at any point and ask questions. So maybe let me just start by giving a short overview. If we're interested in some scattering process, so say you have m ingoing legs and a bunch of outgoing particles, say n minus m. So this would be some n particle process. If we think about computing loop corrections to this, so let's say we're interested in some n particle scattering amplitude, then first of all, you want to organize your calculation. And dropping a lot of details, the aspect I'd like to focus on today is the following, that essentially what you would like at a given loop order is some organization where you organize the amplitude into a set of basis integrals I and some coefficients. And so then, given such an organization, the task is twofold, one to compute these coefficients and one to determine the loop integrals. What's the current state of the art of this at the one loop level? Basically, this has been understood for a long time very well for both of these objects. So we have a very good understanding of what is the basis of loop integrals. They're known analytically, numerically, so we can look them up in some tables. And there's also various methods for computing the coefficients. One of them being generalized unitarity, but also other approaches based on Feynman diagrams. At the two-loop level, the progress is not as great. There, basically, we can essentially do 2-to-2 processes by various means. There's many examples of this, but it's still, although this is in principle possible, it's still each case is certain amount of work depending on the case at hand. An example might be vector boson production, which was done in recent years, where, for instance, these loop integrals, they can be computed using the methods I'm describing today, but they're still a little bit challenging. And but so roughly speaking, maybe I'll just put this in quotation in parentheses. This is possible, but certainly it's fair to say that a challenge. It's still challenging to do 2 to n at the two-loop level. This we can't do in general at the moment. And I'm not going to tell you how to do that today. But today's talk is going to be about the 2-to-3 problem, and in particular the planar case. So today I'm going to solve this part of the problem for you. I'm going to explain to you what is the basis of loop integral functions at two loops for planar 2-to-3 processes. This is for
loops with massless volumes.
This is for planar, and as you rightly point out, this is for massless. So then the massless approximation. So these two restrictions. This is completely general. It's for generic theories, not for some specific toy model that you might have in mind. This is the complete classification. So it applies equally well to a QCD or your favorite supersymmetric extension.
Is there any sort of obvious things you can say that changes going from one to two loops that makes this harder? What's the obstruction?
Is there something? Well, I mean, one thing that gets a lot more complicated is simply the loop integrals themselves. You got a much richer space of functions that things which didn't occur at a one loop order. I would say it's mainly technical. Are there other questions at this point? Okay, so this is plan for today. So these are these two to three processes. You could call them pentagon functions. I would like to tell you something about how we go about computing these loop integrals. So if you have some loop integral, then let me call this F. So if we have some loop integral F, then what is it? It's some integral over space-time, and you might have one integration variable, but you might also have many. In general, would be some L loop integral in d dimensions, and you have some integrand. So some integrand which depends on the loop integration variables, and then on your kinematics. So I want to stress this integrand. If you have some loop integral, you can define a loop integrand. So this is going to be interesting. What we'd like to do is we'd like to take this loop integral and carry out the integrations by some means. So if we carry out the integrations, from experience we know we get some set of special functions. And as you know, there's various methods around for doing this. For instance, in one loop case, you could certainly go about finding and parametrizing and starting to carry out the integrations, and you possibly end up with some logarithms, dilogarithms, and so on. But this process gets increasingly hard, and so this has been a very active field. There are many methods available for how to try to tackle this problem. In this area, there's been a lot of progress in the last years. And one important insight was to look more closely at the loop integrand. And people gradually understood that there are certain properties of loop integrands which are related to properties of the final answer. And it's been observed that there are some loop integrands which have special features which then lead to nice answers. So just write nice or simple answers. I should say a lot of this progress initially, it came from studying examples in supersymmetric theories, where somehow these nice and simple answers were just given to you, and then you wonder why is it the case that this is so. And so people looked in more detail and understood that this is really encoded in properties of loop integrands, and that these properties, they're not intrinsic to those supersymmetric theories. It's actually something which you can just, it's just some properties that you can understand in general. And so then gradually over the last years, this understanding was generalized. So what's this all about? So if you have some loop integrand, it's some rational function of the loop integration variable and loop momenta. And there's a very important concept, which is to take residues. So you can take residues, or so-called leading singularities. So if you have one variable, you can consider a contour integral and compute the residue at some pole. Here, these leading singularities, roughly speaking, they take maximal residues in all of the integration variables. And there's a special feature which is called unit leading singularities. So if you compute these leading singularities and they're all constants, and preferably 1 or minus 1 or 0, then it was observed that these integrals of this type, they lead to these nice and simple functions.
Are we looking at the singularities in general or where the integration contour is pitched?
We're looking at...
There's lots of singularities that you can farm away from them. I'm not sure which ones you're...
Well, we're looking at general singularities of the integrand. So sometimes they have some immediate physical meaning in terms of the special functions that we compute. Sometimes it's also more indirect in the sense that some of those are not visible on the first sheet of these functions. So some of these may not be kind of physically accessible directly. Or another way of saying it is that, when you consider this object, you usually think about integrations in Minkowski space-time. But now really what we're doing is we're looking at other integration contours. So in particular, we're complexifying the problem. So up to this caveat, we're looking at the general singularities of these integrands. Okay. So this is obviously something very nice and easy to do because, sometimes it may require some work, but you have some rational function and the task is to kind of classify the integrals which have this property, which have unit leading singularities. I should also say more recently, it was through work of people here, in particular Zvi, is working on this. This is closely related to the so-called D-log forms of integrands. Which basically is saying that these loop integrals can be cast in a form where this property that they have unit leading singularities is manifest. So just in one variable, it would mean that you have in some variables the integrand looks like this, d tau over tau, and so you could write it as d log of this tau. So this is kind of a toy example, but and then here. You could literally write it as d log, d log, d log, etc. Okay, so there's this nice property of the integrals. There's this conjectured relationship between these. Draw it this way. Between nice simple answers and integrals which have these properties, but we still need a way of actually computing the answer. So it used to be the case that people looked at these integrands, and on the other hand, they had the answer obtained by some other means, and so then they observed these properties. Now it turns out that you can actually combine this insight about the integrands with one of these techniques which people were using, and this is the so-called differential equation technique. So the idea is very simple. You have a loop integral. You want to compute it, so you compute its derivatives. And this technique, it turns out, if you use in this technique as a basis those integrals, it leads to so-called canonical form of the equations. And in this canonical form. This canonical form actually implies, you can use to prove it, that you get these nice simple answers. So this kind of closes the circle. We now no longer have to kind of conjecturally make this connection, but we just have a machinery which also computes these nice answers. And I should say I was being a bit vague about these. What are these special functions? So to be more specific, I already mentioned there are logarithms, there are polylogarithms, multiple polylogarithms. In all of those cases, this already works perfectly, and people have been using it for the last 3 years or so. I should say there's also a class of functions which are called elliptic polylogarithms. And for those, this is still work in progress. But I think it's fair to say that this approach kind of guides a way of also how to continue in those cases. But certainly in the case of multiple polylogarithms, it's already working as a machine the way I've just described it. Okay, so this is kind of the general overview. Now, before going to these pentagon function, I'd just like to show you a very simple example of the main features of this. And my example will be for 2-to-2 processes. So we just imagine we have two ingoing, two outgoing particles. They're all massless, so p squared equals zero. And in this problem, so then we have the usual Mandelstam invariants S, T, and U. So T is P2 dot P3, and U is twice P1 dot P3, and we have they're of course related, S plus T plus U equals zero. So this is just for the kinematics. Now, so these integrals will be functions of those variables, but so only two of them are independent, and actually we're only interested in dependence on the ratio. So in fact these functions are functions of this ratio and in general of the dimension. So we're computing in dimensional regularization in general. Now, if you think about differential equations for such functions, one key property of functions that you can see in differential equations is where their singularities are. So, if you think about differential equations for such two-to-two functions, you should ask yourself, what kind of singularities would I expect to appear in the differential equation? And in fact, it's pretty clear that massless limits such as S going to zero, T going to zero, or U going to zero, they're natural candidates for singularities. And it turns out that actually these are all the singularities that appear here. And so if you set up the differential equations, in general, there's more than one function. There's a set of functions F, set of basis functions. These singularities, you can see them in the equation. So there's a term 1 over x, which precisely has to do with the singularities at either x equals 0 or x to infinity. And it turns out there's another term, b over 1 plus x, which x equals minus 1 has precisely to do with the U-channel singularity. So it turns out that this canonical form of the differential equations, it's actually this one. So there's this singularity structure. And another important feature, epsilon, the dependence on the dimension, only appears in a very special way. And in fact, these two features, the fact that the singularities are manifest and the special dependence on epsilon, are exactly kind of a more mathematical way of saying what I mean about having a nice and simple answer. In particular, given this equation, you can solve perturbatively in epsilon. So you can write down the Laurent expansion for the answer. And in this case, it's the special class of functions. It's some class of functions called harmonic polylogarithms. More generally speaking, it's some iterated integrals where the integration kernels that you have to integrate against, they're d log x and d log 1 plus x. So one can say that these are iterated integrals with this alphabet x and 1 plus x. And so this is just the example of a four-particle amplitude. And so, in fact, it turns out that this canonical form of equations is now going to be very similar also for five-particle amplitudes, with the obvious difference that we're not just going to have one variable x, not just one ratio, there'll be multiple variables, and also there'll be more possible singularities. However, the form of the equations is very similar. So the So here we have iterated integrals. What we can call an alphabet x, 1 plus x. And now this is going to be generalized to the multiparticle case. And really what the generalization is about is knowing what this alphabet is. So what is the alphabet?
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Sure.
What about like just divergent integrals? So the F has some epsilon dependence.
Yes,
that encodes
sure.
The one over epsilon divergence is the W.
Yes, that's right.
In dim, right? I mean, how does this know sort of which, some of the Fs have that additional epsilon dependence?
Yes, indeed. So some of these, in general, these integrals can have divergences. For instance, here they might have, actually they could have both infrared or UV divergences, but just for the sake of the example, if you, one of these Fs would be the massless box with some normalization, and so it would start with a double pole. And indeed, so in general, this is, when I say solve perturbatively in epsilon, I have in mind in general Laurent expansion. So this would, depending on how you normalize your integrals, it would start at some pole or at some power in general in epsilon. So if you used this normalization and maybe some normalization factor to have indeed a unit leading singularity, then this expansion would start with a double pole. And so it's not a problem. So it starts somewhere with a double pole and being a constant. Then the next order would possibly be a logarithm. Then the finite part might be an Li2 and so on and so forth. One important thing is that doing this expansion is completely algorithmic. It's just a kind of a two-line computer code which gives you the subsequent coefficients in the epsilon expansion.
And how does it know when it truncates?
It never truncates, but the user the physicist rather can say, well, I would like to compute some cross section to the finite up to finite terms only, and so if I'm working at the one loop level, perhaps I start at the epsilon to the zero. If actually this is some piece of a two loop computation, I might need some interference terms, and so perhaps you want to expand up to order epsilon squared or so on, and so this is depending on the application, but it's completely straightforward. I should also say that here when I say solving, this is a first order differential equation, so it determines the solution up to a boundary constant. In general, these boundary constants, of course, they can be obtained from simpler calculations because you need them only for a given kinematic point. It turns out, actually, that most of the time, the boundary conditions can be read off from the equations. And here, certainly in the planar case, you can apply some physical insight saying that on the first sheet of the functions, there shouldn't be any U-channel singularities. And this actually turns out to fix these boundary conditions without further calculation. In my experience, this is very often the case, so that usually one doesn't have to worry about boundary constants. Okay. Any other questions on this? Good. So then my task is basically to explain to you what this alphabet is going to be in the pentagon case. So it's going to be very similar from the point of view of kinematics. We just have one more external leg, so we still have pi squared equals zero. Now you can start these functions that we're going to be computing. They will depend on Lorentz invariants, and so the question is, what kind of invariants can we write down? So there'll be a list of invariants, and then there'll be a dependence on the dimension, just as before. Now it turns out that a set of independent invariants is you can obtain in a similar way by a scalar product. So we define V1 to be 2 times P1 dot P2, and then we go around in a cyclic fashion. So V2 is 2 P2 dot P3, and so on. V5 would be 2 times P5 dot P1. So it turns out there's five of these independent invariants. What I mean by this, if you wrote down something like 2 times P1 dot P3, it's also a Lorentz invariant, but it's actually related to the other five. There's some identity, similar to this identity here. So in other words, these are then functions of V1 through V5. If we wanted to, we could take out an overall scale and actually say it's a function of four dimensionless ratios. Okay, so what we did with Thomas and Adriano was to identify these integrals which have unit-leading singularities, such that we had a nice basis. Then we set up differential equations for them, and found that they have a canonical form similar to this one. So basically, what you should imagine is that now you get you don't just write down one equation, but you write down five equations. But in each variable, the equation will look like this. So the right-hand side is proportional to epsilon, and you have a sum over possible singularities. And what's really important then is what these singularities are. And one of the nice outcomes of this project is that there are very nice singularities. So it turns out that there's actually some a generalization of what we have here. So it turns out that so I already wrote for you what V1 is. So this is actually one of the singularities that can appear. It's very obvious, and of course plus psi. So there's five singularities of this type. Then there's some generalization of these U-channel type singularities. So there's 2 times p1 dot p3. This also appears as a term in the equation. And so this in the present kinematics would be v4 minus v1 minus v2. And then of course there's again five of those. Then there's now since we're at five particles, this doesn't stop here. And one of the reasons is you can imagine that there's always four particle subprocesses here. So for instance, you could think of pinching one of the legs here, and then you get something basically 2 to 2 with one massive leg. And this is at least a way of explaining that there's singularities which look like this: 2 times p1, and then scalar product of the sum of two adjacent momenta. And so this would be, for instance, V4 minus V2, and again, plus cyclic. And then there's something similar, now 2 times P1, but now, so here they're adjacent, but now we can also have P3 plus P4. And this would give you V4 plus V5, also plus cyclic. So far it's very similar to the four-point case, just a few more letters. So this would be a 20-letter alphabet. But now there's also another type of singularities which have to do with the Gram determinant. So at five particles you can build a Gram determinant taking four of the linearly independent vectors, and so this we can call delta. And so delta equals 0 is also a special point in the differential equations. So here delta would be, not sure about the coefficient, but you could take the determinant of the matrix of 2 times pi dot pj, where I and j run from 1 to 4. And so this additional type of singularities makes actually everything a little bit more interesting or complicated, if you wish.
What's the assumption of planarity? Or maybe it hasn't shown up yet?
Oh, okay, very good. Yeah, so here, this is the result. The result I'm telling you is for the planar case. So we've studied all the planar two-loop pentagon functions, and so we set up the differential equation, and we read off that there's these types of singularities.
Oh, okay, so these are the singularities for planar.
These are for planar. Okay, yes. Actually, there's also some speculations you can make about non-planar. I strongly expect that it's actually going to be not very much more complicated. That possibly you need to add a letter, but not. I don't think it will change dramatically. But this is work in progress. At the moment, I can just speculate about it. Okay, so we have these singularities. Now it's actually this Gram determinant one is actually a little bit subtle. So it turns out that here, then you can make a list of letters for the alphabet, for the alphabet. And well, depending on how you count, there's the number of letters changes a bit. But one way of representing it, you have 26 letters, which then which are all related to these singularities. Okay. So what this means is that we have we know exactly what the class of generalized polylogarithms is that describe planar two loop 5-point amplitudes, and so we can write them all down. So just to make this more concrete for you, what is it that we've really computed? So so the new classes of integrals. So I just mentioned that if you take a generic 5-particle amplitude and you pinch some leg, you get something which is like a 4-particle one of shell leg, and those have actually all been computed previously by Thomas and collaborators. So here I just want to show you which are the really new ones. Yes.
Just a question about this. So you showed us you have an alphabet with 26 letters, and I'm curious, when you actually did this, mm-hmm. you were able to give a very nice physical explanation of where these all came from, but in practice, when you actually started, did you identify these from the start, or did you actually run a reduction algorithm and see what popped out and kind of afterwards identify this?
Yeah, so thanks for asking this question. So this is this kind of stresses that this is really an automatic tool. So we actually did not this beforehand. This is kind of interpreting the result afterwards, after having computed it. And it's, of course, nice to kind of understand why do we have these letters, what do they mean. But in general, it's actually safer to proceed in a kind of algorithmic way. And the reason is that, while now all of these singularities seem rather sensible, sometimes it may happen that you get letters in the alphabet that are not so sensible. And it's not always possible to kind of predict them beforehand. Perhaps just as an example, if perhaps one might be interested in diagrams which look like this, where you have a Higgs here, some gluons, and you keep the mass of a top quark. There, these things have been computed in the literature at one and two loops, and in some rescaled variable, one finds that this alphabet it contains three letters, x, 1 plus x, and 1 minus x, up to two loops. So you might think, well, and all of those have very sensible physical interpretations in terms of soft limit, thresholds, and so on. So you might think, well, maybe that's it. But then you go to free loops, and then suddenly there's new elements in the alphabet, and there's new letters which are related to roots of unity. What does this mean? There's letters which have singularities not at some simple places like 0, 1, and minus 1, but even at some complex and some, you know, complex positions, which at least I'm not aware of a simple physical interpretation. So it's just a word of warning that it's not always as straightforward as here. This is actually serves to say that this is actually a very nice case where really all of the singularities, they have some very nice physical interpretation, unlike some other cases. Okay, so having said that, so we of course in computing these new integrals, we checked previously existing ones, but the really new ones are ones which look like this. So you have some two loop penta boxes, you have some pentagon with a bubble insertion, and you have some double boxes with five external legs. And you also have some box triangle types, which are, again, in some generic 5-point configuration. And one can count how many actual functions are in there. So here there's three functions in this class. There's two here, there's three here, and there's two there. And, I won't write them down explicitly, but the key point of how they look like is summarized over there. Okay. Any questions at this point? So this was kind of more the rather a technical level. I've solved this this problem for you. So given now imagine that you would like to compute some planar 2-3 amplitude of a two-loop order. Where are we now? So we've got a complete classification of these functions. So they, you can consider them known. There's some can write them down analytically. There's ways of evaluating them numerically. So the problem is now reduced to computing these coefficients. And so there we wanted to apply our results. And it turns out at present in the literature, these coefficients are known for one particular 2-3 amplitude. So obviously what we did is we looked at this specific case and plugged in our integrals and had a look at what comes out. So I'm just going to erase a little bit. By the way, I encourage you to ask questions. You'll be doing me a favor because I'm kind of it's kind of a little bit painful to write on the blackboard. So if you ask questions, I can I can reply, which is nicer. Anyway, so there's the planar all plus helicity amplitude. The integrand of which, so in some sense the CI, they were computed a few years ago in some paper by Badger et al. So then we took this, in other words, the integrand was known. So we took this integrand and now used our results for the functions. This I should say a few words about this all plus amplitude. It's actually a very nice object where, in fact, the tree level amplitude is just zero. Various ways of proving this. So it really just starts at the one loop order, and so that the one loop order. Let me just show you what it is. At a one-loop order, given that it's zero at tree level, it has to be a finite function. There cannot be any UV or infrared divergences. And this finite function, it's we can separate some factor which carries the helicity, and then some finite function f. This rational prefactor we can basically take as the Park-Taylor factor. So this carries the plus helicities, and then in this notation, the finite one-loop function is just the following: it's some products v1, v2, plus cyclic, and then there's also some gamma 5 part. So there's a trace gamma 5, p1, p2, p3, p4. So this has been around in the literature for a while. Now, what's the general structure of a two-loop answer? So again, it kind of makes sense to factor out this coefficient R. Actually, do it a slightly different way. So we'd again like to Now, unlike the one-loop case, there will be divergences, but we know their general form. So we know, in fact, that the divergences must be proportional to the one-loop amplitude. So here it makes sense to factor out such a one-loop term. And then there's some double poles, which mainly some infrared origin. And the general form is the following. There's some sum from 1 to 5 over minus vi over mu squared to the epsilon. So this captures all the divergences that are in the amplitude, and then there's a finite part where again we factor out R and we define some f5 too. And so now obviously we had this expression with the coefficients given by Badger et al. We we had the integrals computed. We did some calculation to match them to the expression from Badgett out to our basis. And so then we verified analytically that we got this specific pole structure. And so then the question is, what's the finite part? This is really the interesting piece.
Your external legs, are you talking specifically about amplitudes, or you have four fermions and one?
So this is all plus helicity amplitudes. It has all external gluons of plus helicity.
Okay. So you're only considering all the one amplitudes?
Yes. Well, then what you can do is you can also consider, there's many generalization of this, but this is the one for which these coefficients were given. As I said, if these coefficients are available for some other amplitude, it's with this machinery that we've developed, one can do a similar analysis. Okay, so what's this two-loop function? Well, so now you might be afraid that it gets a little bit complicated because I've told you about all these pentagon functions. It turns out that actually at intermediate stages of the calculation, many of these things appear. Just to give you a flavor of this, in order to write down this factorized form, just earlier we were talking about interference, there's these double poles in epsilon, and they can talk to higher order terms in the one loop function. In fact, here there's some higher order terms which I didn't write down, and these higher order terms which multiply the poles, they're actually rather complicated. So they involve some of these genuine more complicated pentagon functions which live in this full alphabet. But it turns out that once you separate this off in this nice way, separate off the divergences, then the result for a finite part is extremely simple. And it's actually so simple that I can just write it on this slide. So first of all, there's a term which is proportional to the one-loop function, so just some rational pieces. And then there's two terms. There's one term which is a transcendental function. So it takes the following form. There's a trace minus. So trace minus, instead of the gamma 5, it has a one minus gamma 5 inside. I think with a 1/2, without a 1/2, maybe without a 1/2.
No, without the 1/2.
Without the 1/2. So it's there's a 1 minus gamma 5 here, and then there's again four vectors and some denominator, v2 plus v3 minus v5. And here there's some transcendental function I235, going to define in a second. So this contains some dialogarithms. And then there's another contribution which is just rational, actually. So there's v1, v2, 10/3 plus v1, v3, 2/3. And then there's a very interesting term, 1/6. Trace squared of v4, v5, v1, v2 over v1, v4. Okay, still have to tell you what this function is. Actually, this function here, it's closely related to some function which you know very well. It's I presume many of you know very well. It's the finite part of the one mass box function, and so it's just some dialogarithms. So you can write it as Li2 of that's some v5 minus v2, v5 minus v3 over v2, v3, and there's three more terms of this type. So you see, this is the full result. There's one piece which is of degree 2, meaning that it's basically given by dialogarithms, and there's one rational piece which is here. In principle, the result could have depended on more complicated functions, in particular weighted 4 functions in this alphabet. But as I just said, they all cancel out between the two loop function A5 and this, and separating off this inferred diversion term. In more general amplitudes, they could appear. And as I said, we have them available, but they weren't needed here. So it's very nice that they didn't show up, and we have this answer. We did a number of checks, of course, to make sure that this is correct. So in this Badger et al. Paper, they actually evaluated the integrals numerically. So here we have an analytic formula, so we can also check numerically that we agree. So there's a numerical check. One very interesting check is actually the collinear limit. So we have a numerical check. And the collinear limit is actually very interesting. Collinear limit. So in general, if you have some amplitude, when two of the external legs become collinear, there's some factorization going on. So you get the amplitudes factorize into amplitudes of one leg less. So these two legs merge. And then you have some splitting function, which looks like this. So this would be some splitting function. And actually, there's also a sum here, which is rather important. And the sum goes over different loop orders L, and also runs over the helices that are exchanged here. And this is quite interesting here, because in the for our specific two-loop amplitude of all plus helices, it turns out that there's 3 different contributions here, so which all have to be reproduced. And I just want to focus on one particular one. So these are 3 terms. But a particular interesting term is the one where there's some helicity flip. So where you have and this is actually loop-induced. So there's a one-loop splitting function, specific splitting function, which is a plus one, and where you here have a minus, a single minus amplitude. And this is interesting because this contribution has a very has kind of a signature dependence on it on the kinematics, and in particular, so if these, let's say these legs would become collinear in 4 and 5, then this has so in general then one expects that generic terms in the splitting, they behave like this 1/4, 5. Which is actually one of the terms from this prefactor here. This would be standard. This contribution here, it's more subtle. It's kind of in spinner helicity notation. It's 4/5/4/5 squared. So this is what some people call, I think Zvi and Lanz perhaps like to call this unreal poles. Why could one call these unreal poles? Well. You see, for these are poles which really only exist in complex kinematics. But if you
a double pole in complex kinematics,
exactly,
and a single pole in real kinematics.
Yeah,
unreal
absolutely.
Poles are the ones that only have one power downstairs, not 2.
Exactly, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. Thank you. So these are rather unusual and rather subtle. So now how do we see them here? For most of the terms in this F5, the collinear limit is actually very easy. You can just basically plug it in, and the pole comes from this prefactor. However, there's one type of terms where it's not so easy, and this is this one here. So this V4 is actually a scalar product of P4 and P5. So this diverges, but there's also this trace here in the numerator. And so you have to be very careful. It's roughly speaking 0/0, so you have to parameterize carefully. And turns out that this trace goes to 0 as if you parameterize the collinear limit of delta going to 0, then this trace, it goes as delta, but then it's squared, and this V4 also goes as delta squared. So the ratio is then finite, you can compute it, and near the limit, then it behaves as this, you get this extra phase.
Actually also be interpreted as a one-loop splitting function. There's an interpretation like that.
Yes.
I couldn't read that. Oh yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the analog. What's this is kind of the general story, and so this has to be reproduced by a formula, and it is reproduced in this a little bit subtle way. So this is very nice to see. Okay, so these were two checks. Just very recently, I should say, there was an independent calculation by Dunbar and Perkins that independently, using some other method, using Gaussian relations, recomputed this. And they actually also pointed out a typo in our formula, so we thank them for them. So this is a plus, not a minus, in fact. So there's a lot of good reasons to think that this is correct. Okay. Any more questions on this this formula?
Do you ever have to worry about the gamma 5 in d dimensions? Or can you stick to 4 of them?
Okay. Well, I think one always has to worry about gamma 5s. As kind of the main point of this calculation was the computation of the integrals. And my notes in the discussion of the integrals, I actually never talked about gamma 5. And the reason is that these are just depend on Lorentz invariants. And so we actually compute them in d dimensions. There's no ambiguities whatsoever about the gamma 5. So whatever ambiguities are there have to do with your prescription for how to organize the amplitude.
So how did they do this?
So let's see. So there, yeah, you have to worry about a scheme. And as far as I recall, they computed a four-dimensional helicity scheme. I think they also do comment on what you might have to change if you compute in a different scheme.
Well, Betcher collaborates. They basically split the space fluid momenta in 4D and D minus 4D, and they then have expressions in terms of some of the D minus 4D integrals, which by means of kind of unraveling the whole thing in integration by parts framework, you can then relate to the fully d-dimensional integrals. I mean, there technically it's not much different from what Lance and Sui did for the two-loop Fourgeluin amplitudes about 10-12 years ago.
Is there also a delta R dependence in the integrand, or do you stick with? I guess Young also was on that paper. So you provide delta R dependence when you to switch between a Tuff-Veltman and FDH scheme, or just stick with FDH?
They just stick to FDH. I mean, here, as Johannes said, we took over the results from Badger and Company, where they actually just used Mellin bounds to compute the integrals numerically, and then we transformed their integrals into sort of the purely d-dimensional integrals that we have computed. So different basis set for the integrals, and then you actually basically got rid of the ambiguity. Now they do not provide you the scheme transformation at the integrand level.
Any other questions?
When you're talking about these limits, the fact that you're using angle and square brackets, are you in four dimensions when you say that, or how does that?
Are we in four dimensions when we say that? Well, yes. So here, this concerns the external kinematics. So here, this is the four-dimensional helicity scheme. So we're assuming in that scheme, you assume that the internal loop integration variables are in d dimensions, and the external ones are in four dimensions.
Oh, okay, I see.
Okay, actually, maybe I should just say, I guess I should have said this when discussing the alphabet. This is perhaps for the experts, but I started out by saying that, we're doing pentagon functions now, or we're doing hexagon functions before, so how does this all match? So this is there's some interesting connection between this story and supersymmetric theories. It turns out that in n equals 4 superring mills, you have a dual conformal symmetry, and this extra symmetry, it basically, very roughly speaking, it kind of buys you two external legs for free. So kind of what usually would be, in a very rough way, what usually would be a six particle amplitude in n equals 4 is kind of roughly 4. So you kind of go by two. To make this more precise, and there's a very nice way of there's a nicer way of viewing the kinematics, of viewing the in particular massless kinematics, and this is something which is called momentum twisters. Without defining them in detail, what are these momentum twisters? There's kind of two problems with the for usual description of kinematics, which is that we have some constraints. There's pi squared equals zero, on-shell constraints, and we have momentum conservation constraints. Just to put it very briefly, what momentum twisters do, they solve both of these constraints simultaneously, so you just have three variables to work with. It's like an immersion into some manifold defined by these constraints. So this is very useful. And so now there's some analogy one can make. If we consider seven-point kinematics in n equals 4 superring mills, it turns out that there's seven momentum twisters, Z1 through Z7. And you can think of them as being arranged in some cyclic way. Try to... something like this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Very good. So where the twisters kind of define some polygon. And so there's a way of thinking about the kind of functions which appear for seven particle processes in n equals 4 superring mills in terms of these twisters. Now, what does this have to do with our case? So it turns out, as I mentioned, that kind of two of these twisters, you could say 6 and 7, their dependence doesn't really enter in n equals 4 superring mills because of some extra symmetry. So you can somehow think of it as 5 plus 2, and so in QCD for 5 point, you can literally think of just 5 twisters. Z1 through Z5, but you need some extra scale. And this extra scale, it's usually people call it some infinity twister. It's some bi-twister, but you can also represent it just by two twisters, say 6 and 7. And so we have a picture where we can also use 7 twisters to describe the kinematics, but the geometry is a little bit different. So here we just have these 5 twisters, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, arranged in a cyclic fashion, and we have a line which is built from 6 and 7. But so apart from this difference, it's these pentagon functions that I'm describing here. So in particular, this alphabet, it's you can rewrite it, express it in terms of these twister variables in a very natural fashion, and it's very similar to what people discuss in the supersymmetric world. And so this is also just to explain why is this somehow a little bit more than 6 points in n equals 4 superring mills. This is actually more closely related to the 7 point case in n equals 4 superring mills. And so this is just a comment on work in progress. There seems to be something even more fundamental about this alphabet, and so it's work in progress to see what are really the connections of the n equals 4 world. Yes.
So how should I interpret this? Because let's start with 7 points. My 7 momentum twisters are free. I can choose them in any way I like.
Sure.
Now, how does this relate to the picture with the pentagon and the line? Because my 7 twisters on the n equals 4 cycle are free. So I could choose the same 5 and go to QCD. So how does this? How do I see the distinction between the fact that in one case I have a heptagon, and the other case I have a pentagon on the line, while in all cases it's just 7 points in crystal space?
Yes.
So where is the distinction between the two cases?
Yes. So this is the last thing you just said was exactly the point I was making. In both cases you have seven twisters, but now the interpretation of the objects that you write down with these seven twisters changes. In N equals 4 sweeping mills, since there's dual conformal symmetry, you write down certain cross ratios. So in some sense, the dependence on 6 and 7 is very constrained. Here you also write down, you can write down ratios because you may want to consider dimensionless objects, V1 through V3, for example. So they look formally similar, but the other difference is that here, for planar amplitudes, you have some cyclic invariants in the 7 twisters, while here we also have some cyclic invariants, but only in 5 twisters. So it's this. So here you have 7, and here you have 5 plus 2. This is really the main difference, and this changes some things, but it doesn't. You know, there's still a lot of
sort of similarities. So you're saying that in the 7-point case, you have to kind of kill all the conformal weights for every single twister, while in the PCB case. Well, since you introduce the infinity twister, you can have some.
Even here, you kind of balance the weights by considering ratios. But it's true, you don't have to kill all the weights. That's right.
Especially against 7 and 6, you're not going to kill them because it's in infinity. Because otherwise, you would go back to the cosmo picture.
Yes. I mean, there's some differences, but it's kinematically it's very similar, and this is what I wanted to point out.
So to say it another way, there are 42 letters over here, and you said 26 or 25 letters over here, right?
Exactly. So in particular, the number of
constraint on the 42 letters that you use to get the 25 letters.
Yeah, so I'm not saying, that's right. I'm not saying that there's the relationship is a little bit more subtle, but yes, in particular, there's not the same number of letters. Perhaps another way of saying it is that here, 6 and 7, they can appear in independently, whereas here they always appear in the combination because they form this line. So this is also one difference. But still, despite these differences, there's a lot of similarities if you compare the...
Is that constraint enough to reduce it to 26 letters? That in the four brackets, 6 and 7 should always be together?
The counting is really a little bit subtle, so I'm very happy to discuss more with you on that.
Yes, no, because you also need to kill off the disparities as well.
Okay, so this is kind of a comment for the experts. N equals 4 sweeping mills is always a little bit like science fiction, kind of allows you to look into the future, but as you could see in the talk, it you know, after a while it also comes back into the real world, and then all these futuristic things, they have their applications. So these comments are kind of for the next steps into the future, so to speak. Okay, I don't know what do you like me to do. We can stop here. I could say one or two words on the for loop form factors. You could ask questions. I don't know. People are interested.
Thank you. As Johannes said, for questions?
About non-planar, can you comment? I happen to be thinking of a certain integral, 3-loop non-planar, 4-point.
Ah, okay, so not non-planar 5-point, but you're asking about non-planar 4-point.
Just 4-point, but 3-loop.
Right. Yes, so earlier I think on around here on the slide I had these differential equations for a 4-point case. So where there's just singularities x1 plus x, so that's very nice. And I didn't actually say to which specific 4-point amplitudes these applied. One remarkable thing there is that, as far as we know, so far all cases that have been computed so far, they fit exactly into this pattern. So there's really just these three singularities: s equals 0, t equals 0, u equals 0. And as far as I know, it applies both to planar and non-planar. So there, nothing qualitative changes as you go from planar to non-planar. So as you know, maybe let's draw a few pictures. So for 2 to 2, the equation was this one. And so one qualitatively one important question to ask is, does this stay the same? So as you know, so the planar cases are kind of exhausted by these two pictures. And then I think there's up to seven kind of topologies you can write down in the non-planar ones. There was one case which kind of was very interesting to us, which is this kind of diagram, where which is a little bit subtle from our point of view, because you see when you compute leading singularities, it's very nice when you have 3-point vertices. Because 3-point vertices, when they're on shell, they're very simple. And this is a new diagram that you can have only in the non-planar case, where there's only 4-point vertices. So this was a case where we were thinking, well, this could potentially be something where some new feature happens, perhaps a new letter appearing, perhaps some problem with this canonical form. And so this we analyzed in detail, and it's rather complicated. But in the end of the day, it turns out that it's also in this class. So this is just to say this would have been the one place where I would have worried at 3 loops. 4-point non-planar, that perhaps something new could happen, but it doesn't, and so you can be pretty confident that the answer will be just given by this form, so harmonic polylogarithms.
What difficulties do you see in working it out in this and the?
I mean, there's no in principle difficulties. What can I say? So this, as I explained, this is a system of equations. So really what changes when you change the loop order is how many integrals you have here. So typically at the free loop level, you have about hundreds of integrals. But it's just basically computer algebra. So if there's a bottleneck, it may just have to do with computer algebra, but there's certainly no in-principle bottleneck. Now, if you're asking me how long is this going to take, I mean, it depends a little bit on my time. Thanks to visits like this KRTP visit, I can actually work on it more quickly. So I don't know. Could be order of a month, could be order of a year, probably more order of a year. It's because it's still technically very challenging. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, that's good.
A and B are just rational numbers, are they?
A and B are basically numbers. So here I kind of went very quick over this notation. This is a vector. So here A and B are actually n by n. So if this is an n vector, so say you compute 10 integrals, this is a 10 by 10 matrix. But importantly, this matrix is independent. It's just numbers inside it. So it's independent of the kinematics and independent of epsilon. So a given problem, it's just some matrix of numbers.
Within this framework, what is the technical problem for going to elliptic integrals?
So for elliptic integrals, you can follow the same logic, and it requires two generalizations. Well, since we have this framework here, from a point of view of the canonical form, the fact that you have epsilon factorized out, it kind of implies immediately that you have polylogarithms. On the other hand, the fact that you see the singularities very clearly is completely general. So this is not going to change. So what can change here is that you can have another term. So there's a proposal for generalization of this, where you have a term which is epsilon to the 0 or 1 and would multiply a similar bracket. So this is a proposal for completely general form, for not just elliptic, actually for any Feynman integral. Where the difference is that even as epsilon is 0, even in 4 dimensions, you can have a coupled system of equations. So on the from the point of view of the algebraically, it's this. But you can also ask a question, so what happens at the integrand level where we computed these leading singularities? And there it will amount to some generalization of what we mean by leading singularity in the elliptic case.
Just to this part, so the
one term in the bracket will not at all be dependent on epsilon, right?
This term here, yes, this is independent.
C over x plus d over 1 plus x.
Oh, this yeah. So yeah, so I have an argument in my lecture notes that proposes this form and argues here by definition this shouldn't depend on epsilon. You might ask about is there some epsilon to the square or further term? Yeah. And so I have an argument that this is irrelevant. So if it's there, it can be transformed away. So really, the key would be these two terms. A way of thinking about it is that if you have elliptic functions, then you need such a structure. You need some kind of coupled system which generates a complete elliptic integral to start with. And then you can think of this epsilon piece as some decoration. You have some kind of elliptic kernel, and then you perturb it a little bit and create by iterating this, you create higher weight functions. But really, this is the key of having the zero order term. But it doesn't matter if you perturb it with epsilon or epsilon squared or something else. But does this answer your question?
Somehow it means that even if you have elliptic functions, you can always find a form where epsilon is factored out completely of the rest of the amplitude.
Well, what I'm proposing is that there's this form where we have epsilon factor out here, but there's also a constant piece.
Yeah.
So this is a proposal that I made. I don't think it's proven yet. I have a kind of argument leading there. You can see it explicitly in the case of the sunrise integral, where I give a basis choice, which precisely leads to such a form. But then I think it's also a very active field of research, so hopefully we'll hear a lot more about such things in the coming months and years.
In the n equals 4 case, there are classes of integrals that are nice, that is transcendental and also infrared finite. Mm-hmm. So the problem is that if you can set epsilon equal to 0, then the equation doesn't give you much.
Okay, so what happens? You're asking about what happens.
This is very nice when you are building off of something that has a 1 over epsilon to some power pole, and then that becomes the source term, and you iterate up and get these integrals. But you might also be interested in classes of integrals that are arranged to be infrared finite.
Absolutely, and I'm very interested in those.
And that form isn't so useful, right?
No, no. And unfortunately, I have to disagree with you. It's actually still very useful. It's just that in the case where you have finite integrals, you can simplify it further. So this you can still you can still set up this form, but then you can actually use this additional insight of saying, well, my basis integrals are actually finite, to take the epsilon to zero limit in a meaningful way. And so, roughly speaking, if you think about the integrals, we were discussing this before, as some Laurent expansion, so some k bigger equal than k zero, you have epsilon to the k, and then you have some coefficients. In one thing, as you just mentioned, what this nice form implies is that these functions here have uniform weight k. And but this expansion here in principle is infinite. So you have more and more complicated term in a sense, or more in terms of more and more weight that you generate here. In the case of finite integrals, just by definition, this expansion somehow stops, or in other words, it just has one term. So you might have, for instance, say a very particular peculiar example. You might have this massive box function, which is weight 2. If I consider this in d dimensions, then this would just be the first term, but there's this whole epsilon tail, so there's a lot more information. And the differential equation knows about this information, allows you to deal with it, so in particular allows you also to compute these high-order terms. But of course, it's possible to take the epsilon to zero limit, and then something very nice happens. Then in this case, and this is a general thing, is that you only have a few terms in the differential equation. Actually, in this case, you know, you differentiate this once, you get weight one terms. You differentiate these twice, you get a weight zero function, which is just a function one. So if you take the four-dimensional limit, your equations become simpler, and they actually have an additional hierarchical structure. There's some grading with respect to weight that you can see. And this additional structure, it means that your matrices A and B, they have certain blocks. So in other words, if you take the derivative of this, you find zero up here, and only non-zero items here corresponding to these arrows. So this is something very interesting. There's kind of two ways of thinking about it. One way is kind of the pedestrian way, is to say, well, let's start with a d-dimensional method, set this up, but then actually remember some of the integrals, or actually we choose all of our basis integrals to be finite, and then we can take this limit and we see this occurring. Or the kind of conceptually nicer approach is to say, let's just work immediately in four dimensions and try to recover the structure. And this is also possible, and it's actually technically very advantageous, because you basically throw away all this epsilon tail that maybe you don't even need. Actually, even beyond n equals 4 supermills, if we're considering, you know, many of these integrals for if this is the top quark, would be actually finite integrals that we'd need to compute. We could compute directly these finite integrals without having to care about all the epsilon corrections. So this is something we worked out with Simon Caron-Hiot in some paper from, I think, 2 years ago. So in particular, we computed some finite free loop integrals, which are kind of this type. We did have some, as you mentioned, we did have some n equals 4 application in mind for this. But some of these integrals, of course, happen to coincide with integrals one may want to know in QCD.
Thank you very much.